There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Annalisa. This episode is about the mechanics of birth. Basically, what happens or should happen. It's not about what you should do or the sort of birth you should have. That's for you to decide. My guest today is Amy Sutton Cole, who was one of the midwives for my second pregnancy and birth. My other midwife was Siobhan Taylor. Siobhan wasn't there for the actual birth, but she was there throughout my anti and postnatal treatment and made me some amazing casseroles after my baby was born. Amy Sutton Cole is now the lead research midwife in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at the University of Cambridge. She's also study coordinator for the Pregnancy Outcome Prediction Study 2. Amy started work in the department in 2020, having previously worked as a senior research midwife in the NHS. She's received a Chief Midwifery Officer Silver Award for her work in reproductive health and childbirth research. Amy was an independent midwife for a time, which is when I met her. In this episode, we talk about what happens when you go into labour, optimum positions for birth, why it takes so damn long for a baby to move what seems just a couple of centimetres, and the wild movements babies get into as they make their way out. We also talk about how labour really isn't like how it's often represented on film and TV. Just to give you some context, my first child was born by emergency C-section. I was in labour for 36 hours. I was then given an epidural and induced. Then I had a full spinal and a try of forceps before being given a C-section. After this, and in order to help me understand what happened, I worked as a lay rep at the hospital my child was born at for the next 4 years, sitting on three committees. I read as much as I could about labour and read pretty much every NICE guideline there was. When I got pregnant with my second child, I decided to try for an HBAC, a home birth after caesarean. My second child was born at home, in water, in front of the fire, while my elders slept upstairs. I'd taken two paracetamol. Both my births were amazing. I hope you enjoy this episode and find it empowering. If you'd like to listen to this podcast ad-free and before it goes on general release, please consider becoming a patron from just £3 a month, or you can give a one-off donation via Acast Supporter. Both links will be in the episode description. Amy, hello and welcome. And who would have thought all those years ago when I dragged you away from your new husband on your first Valentine's night to deliver my baby that we would be doing a podcast together? But there you go, that's the way life goes. We're going to talk about the mechanics of birth. And I'd really like to start with a question that I've always wondered about, which is who or what decides that the baby's going to go into labour? Is it something with the mother or is it the baby that kind of presses an imaginary button?
I think the most honest answer is that we don't fully understand it, and it's likely to be several things that interact. We believe that it's something that the baby decides when they're ready to be born, but we know that we can help induce labour when we have a reason for a baby to be born earlier than it's perhaps ready to be born naturally and the body has decided. So we can do things to help artificially start labour.
Starting off talking about labour happening naturally, There are various ways that labour can happen. I mean, with my first child, I had spontaneous rupture of membranes, which is when your waters break. But with my second child, the one that you helped deliver, it was completely different. Labour can start with a couple of ways, can it?
It can start many different ways. And I think your experience is definitely the way it often starts in the movies. The waters often break first. And I think in reality, that's the least common way for labour to start. Most times people tend to start to feel some mild period type pains and be able to carry on with their day and not be quite sure. And as the day wears on, those period type pains become more regular and contractions are often the first sign. Or what we call a show, where some mucus or some blood can be passed vaginally, and that can sort of herald the sign of that labour's happening.
That's the mucus plug you're talking about?
Yes, which just sits in the cervix and protects the pregnancy, but does come away when labour's starting. So often contractions are the most common way for labour to start, but waters breaking can be another way. And I know, you know, most people expect that to happen first because we do see it a lot in the movies. But generally, that tends to not happen until contractions are regular and somebody is in quite advanced established labour. And sometimes the waters don't break at all. Babies can be born in the bag of waters, and we need to break them once baby's born in a small number of cases.
Yeah, they're born in the caul, it's called, isn't it? The sort of the
yes,
sac.
It is.
Have you ever delivered a baby in the caul?
Only once in 20 years.
Gosh. Do we have any idea why that happens sometimes?
No, I think if labour's very natural and gentle, I guess some waters just, the bag of waters must be made tough and it doesn't break. It's interesting that it can happen so differently for so many different people and the same woman in different labours with different children.
Yeah.
It can happen very differently.
Well, mine were so different. We'll sort of talk about that as we progress. Why do waters break? Do we know?
So the waters are there to keep babies safe from infection, ascending up from the vagina. But as babies are born, you know, they have to be out of the waters to take their first breath when they are born. So at some point they will have to break. And the pressure of uterine contractions during labour often will burst that bag of waters.
We hear a lot about contractions. Obviously, it's kind of the main thing in labour. Can you explain what they are?
So contractions are the uterus, the womb that the baby is growing in, is basically a large muscle. And it will pulse and contract like as muscles do when the body is labouring. It also happens during the later parts of pregnancy and is called a Braxton Hicks, a sort of practice contraction. And it's that helps the baby to descend through the pelvis to be born.
So the contractions are kind of pushing the baby out?
Pushing the baby out. The uterus doesn't want to just contract and push the baby out in one go. The baby needs to get oxygen from the placenta. So they come and they go to keep giving the baby the oxygen and nutrients they need during labour, but each time just bringing the baby a little bit further down into the pelvis to be born.
I didn't know that. So during the contractions, are they not getting stuff from the placenta?
They will still be getting something, but it will be restricted.
Right, I see. And is that one of the reasons, if a labour goes on for too long, that people start getting concerned?
It can be, and it can be one of the reasons that we worry about if we're performing an induction or contractions naturally are just coming very, very close together, that baby's not getting a break and a rest and the placenta's not able to just reissue them a surge of oxygen.
Yeah, never mind about poor mum not getting a break. So contractions are the ones we kind of know of. And I know that with my second child, which was the most sort of, I imagine, textbook labour, I mean, I couldn't even time them. I remember earlier on in the afternoon, I was having a bath. And my eldest was talking to me and I realised a couple of times I couldn't answer her. I couldn't talk. And then I just remember sort of they started and I remember calling you. But from then on, I think from the moment you came, I was just gone. I was away with the fairies. There was no hope of me like timing my contractions. There's phases of labour, aren't there, Amy? Can you explain what they are?
So you'll often hear the terms latent phase of labour, first phase of labour, second stage and third stage. And the latent phase of labour is often only experienced with first pregnancies, and it's early contractions where it's getting baby into a good position for labour, the cervix is softening and ripening, and you would generally be able to carry on with your daily activities, but you might have to stop occasionally, or you might be aware of some period type pain or some contractions. But contractions aren't regular and you can carry on with everyday life. Then we'd say the first stage of labour is when contractions are regular, around 3 to 4 in 10 minutes and lasting for about 30 seconds each. And we wouldn't expect women necessarily to be timing those themselves. Time does blur a little bit when you're in labour, but that's often the role of a birth partner to have a look at timing contractions. And also, particularly in first labours, women tend to contact the maternity unit quite a few times to talk about the right time to come in or the right time to call a midwife to a home birth when they're working out whether they're in the first stage of labour or not.
Is that the purpose of timing contractions?
Yes. Yep. Just because you probably don't want somebody with you from the moment you start to contract, in the way a watch pot never boils, you know, having someone in your house or going into hospital, you know, really early, it's not very conducive to progressing in labour. So as a general rule, we'd say 3 to 4 contractions in 10 minutes, lasting about 30 seconds each.
Okay. And then what's the next stage?
The next stage would be the second stage of labour, which is when your cervix is fully dilated, 10 centimetres, and you're ready to push, or you're having that strong urge to push if you haven't had a vaginal examination and we don't know what the cervix is doing. We would say when you have that strong urge to push, that's the second stage of labour. And while baby is descending through the pelvis and you're pushing with contractions, that would be the second stage. Once baby's then born, the body will give you a little bit of a rest and then start to contract to deliver the placenta. And that we would call the third stage of labour, when the placenta is being delivered.
And the placenta, so when the baby is implanted at the beginning of pregnancy, the umbilical cord grows from the baby to the placenta, or maybe the other way round. But basically the placenta is attached to the uterine wall, isn't it? And
yes,
that's where the baby breathes and gets all its nutrients from. Is that also what carries away the waste products?
It is, and I find the placenta absolutely fascinating, and I do enjoy, where parents want to, having a look at the placenta with the baby, because it's the only time you'll get to see an organ that your body's produced, where something nice has happened and something horrible has not happened and a reason for it to be removed. But it's a fascinating organ. It's very, very clever at transporting everything that baby needs to them and the waste away, with these thick spiral arteries into the uterus. And then a nice thick juicy cord that's got Wharton's jelly, a sort of white jelly substance, to really protect it going to baby.
I do slightly regret not looking at mine, but you know, I've heard tales it looks like a kind of giant liver.
Yeah, one side looks like lots of little livers joined together in the size of a sort of side plate to a dinner plate. They can vary in size in the way that humans vary in size and newborn babies do. Yeah, one side looks like lots of little pieces of liver, and the other side is shiny because it's got the bag of Wharton's on it, and you can see quite clearly veins and arteries then going up into the cord on the shiny side, the baby's side. So there'll be two layers for the bag of Wharton's that goes around baby, and that's attached to the placenta on one side with the cord coming out of it. And then the other side is the side that looks like lobes of liver attached to mum's uterus.
Yeah, I imagine that side looks a bit like barnacles kind of attached.
Yeah.
Back to the contractions. So the contractions have obviously a role in that do they turn the baby? Do they just squeeze it? What do they? Because also, what's the cervix doing?
When contractions are happening, the baby is coming down through the pelvis, and that's what contractions are designed to do. And I think we often think of babies as being quite passive when they're being born, but they do take quite an active role. It's exhausting for them, and newborn babies sleep quite well in that first 24 hours because they've had a lot of work to do, just like
their
mum.
What are they doing?
So they're coming down through the pelvis with those contractions, and as they meet the pelvic floor, the muscle, that sling of muscles within the bony pelvis, the baby turns and navigates its way through the pelvis and through the vaginal canal to be born. So baby's stimulated, and various parts of its anatomy will be stimulated to adopt certain positions as it navigates its way through the pelvis. So babies are quite clever at turning and doing what they need to do to facilitate birth.
And they just know this instinctively, obviously.
So babies can be born either head first, which we call cephalic, or bottom first, which we call breech.
Never feet first. So breech is not necessarily feet first, it's bottom first.
Bottom first. So if babies were coming feet first, we probably wouldn't then want to proceed with a vaginal delivery. We'd probably more recommend a cesarean section because things are unlikely to be coming as smoothly if babies are feet first.
So breech is really bottom first.
Yeah. And it's incredible when you see a baby being born breech, you can see the baby as it's coming out, going through these manoeuvres externally. We know from textbooks and what's happening internally, but when you see a baby being born that's breech, you can see it externally and it's just incredible.
Describe what it's doing.
So the baby has to turn to navigate through the pelvis, because if you feel your own skull, if you tuck your chin to your chest, you can feel that just the top back of your head is quite small, but if you lift your head up, the top of your head is quite wide. And so babies tuck and twist and turn as they navigate the pelvis. And if a baby is breech, certainly once they're almost out and just the top of their head is still inside mum, they will be stimulated by their feet touching the ground and they will nod their head to be born.
Wow.
So they just know they have to tuck their head for that last manoeuvre.
My second child was born in the water. Mm. And I remember her head was out. And I remember I had this mad feeling of, I've got to continue with this because I can't carry on for the rest of my life with the baby's head between my legs, which I think must have been that transitional period where you do slightly think mad thoughts. But I remember her head turning and I said to you, one of the few things I said, why are you turning her head? And you said, I'm not touching her. So her head was out, but why was she moving her head?
The diameter of your pelvis is wide at the top, narrow in the middle, and then widens out again at the bottom. And as that happens, babies have to navigate by twisting their heads to get through. So when a baby is just born, the point we call crowning, where able to be visualised externally, their head will have just passed, looking at your back, so with the back of their head towards your front, and baby will have passed under that front hip bone that you can feel if you push just on your bony pelvis at the front. Mm. But then to navigate their shoulders coming out and being born, they'll then turn to look at one of your thighs, and that can be right or left that babies turn, but they need to twist their head and their shoulders inside just to be born that final bit from the head being first visible at crowning to being born fully.
Right, it's the bit I didn't know, and I remember it freaked me out because I was just like, what is happening? Given that, you know, we've evolved over so many millions of years, why is it not in the right position straight away? I've understood about the contractions to give the baby a break, but why can't it just be in the right position?
It's a little bit of a compromise. Humans have grown to be rather brainy, and our brain is in our head, which needs to come out of the body in human pregnancy. But equally, that mum can't give birth to a baby when they're completely defenceless and not fully ready for life externally. Now we walk upright and we have quite large heads. The compromise is that babies are born at 9 months, but they are relatively helpless and need lots of care from the caregivers in those first months of life, but that they are small enough to come out, but they do need to navigate the pelvis with that sort of compromised time point, we believe.
Yeah. And I guess also it's a case of being able to be carried comfortably, but then sort of coming out. I mean, it's really, really amazingly clever. And as I experienced birth naturally the second time around, and I could feel things going on. I remember my pelvis. It reminded me a bit of that sort of scene in Thunderbirds. I could feel my pelvis opening. Was that my imagination?
No, your pelvis is, while it is bone and it is solid, it does have cartilage at the front and it is designed to be able to manoeuvre and be quite dynamic, particularly during birth. So you will feel your pelvis moving during labour. Not everybody will experience that to the same level of intuitiveness that you have. You know, you were very relaxed and hypnobirthing and calm. And so I think you were very in tune with your body.
So contractions are basically just, in heavy inverted commas, your muscle contracting.
It is, like any other muscle in the body. And, you know, period type pains are that muscle contracting when you're shedding your endometrium for periods. But contractions in labour are a similar but slightly different function.
I found between child number one and child number two, I worked for 4 years in a maternity hospital and I read practically everything there was. And I was certainly much more informed. And because I understood what was going on, it really helped me. Do you find that's true of some women or some, because people cope differently with labour pains and people have asked me what labour's like and it's really hard to explain because it's not a pain like going to the dentist and then you kind of going, ouch, or at least it wasn't for me. It was a sort of, it was intense. Mm. But once I found out that my uterus was a muscle and once I understood what was going on and that it was actually like a helpful thing, it did help me. Do you think women, in your experience, if they know what's going on, it helps them? Or is it better to kind of just switch off?
I think knowledge is power. And I think it's always good to learn a lot about a topic. And I think women going into labour where they're informed feel much more empowered. They know to a certain extent what to expect. And they've had a think about meeting different stages of labour and what they would like to do and discuss that with their birth partner often. So their birth partner is able to support them. I have looked after some women who haven't researched it very much, and particularly a lot of the farming community out in the Fens. They'll often know a lot about animal labours, but aren't so bothered about coming to antenatal classes and learning everything. And they tend to cope wonderfully because they see how well normal labour works for their animals. And they expect and have a lot of faith in their body, because why would it not work for one species when it works so well for others? But a lot of the people I look after do attend antenatal classes and I think find a lot of benefit in that.
Contractions, again, I can only talk about my experience. They kind of definitely got into a rhythm. And then as well as sort of manoeuvring the baby, what's happening with the cervix during labour?
So the baby's head will be putting pressure onto the cervix with those contractions. And the cervix is actually part of the uterus, the womb. It's the bottom part. And if you think about a balloon before it's been blown up, and it has that little tail part at the bottom. Mm-hmm. But when you blow the balloon up, that bottom part becomes part of the balloon. Right. And that's a little bit like pregnancy. The top part of the vagina, the cervix, is part of the uterus and will be drawn up to form the bottom part of the uterus during pregnancy. And then in labour, the baby will push their head against the cervix. And in a first pregnancy, the cervix sits quite long and feels sort of a little bit like the tip of your nose, quite solid. And it has to soften first till it feels sort of more like your lips and is soft before it then starts to dilate. And everybody thinks of that dilation to 10 centimetres from the movies, 10 centimetres being fully dilated and when the baby can pass through the cervix. And of course, we don't get a ruler out and measure. It's always an approximation when we're assessing how many centimetres somebody is dilated in labour. When you've had a baby before, that softening of the cervix before it starts to dilate can all happen in one go. It's like your body thinks, I've done this before, I can multitask it this time. But with your first labour, there tends to be a sort of set pattern of things where the cervix will start to soften and ripen before it starts to dilate, and it thins and it naturally sits sort of tucked more towards your bottom, and it starts to come a little bit more forwards to your front during early labour.
It does. So your womb, the door does open. I know one of the things that really threw me with my first, and obviously you weren't there, but I saw so many midwives. I was in the hospital and every one of them had a different interpretation of how dilated I was. I mean, you know, you sort of said we don't get a ruler out, but I sort of thought there would be a standard and everyone told me something different. And then fast forward to when I had my second child with you, I only had one vaginal examination, VE, and that was the very end. Because I'd never actually birthed vaginally, we had discussed that you would need to check that my cervix was fully dilated. Generally speaking, why is there such a difference in interpretation of how dilated you are?
I think because it isn't an exact science, and the cervix obviously can open and close. It has to close again after labour.
But can it open and close during labour?
There is not lots of documented evidence, but I am sure where I have had continuity of care with some women that where something that's caused a lot of anxiety for them has happened, when I have re-examined, I am sure that their cervix has started to close in labour.
Interesting, because of course, if the baby's not presenting correctly, you won't dilate. And that's what happened with child number one.
Yeah.
She was presenting with her forehead, so the largest part of her head. She was taller than 99.9% of babies born in this country. And I don't think my interpretation, after having read the notes many times and gone through them with many midwives, I don't think she could turn her head. But that is correct, isn't it? That if the baby's not presenting, the cervix will protect you.
Yeah, so if the baby's not applying an even pressure with their head onto the cervix won't dilate as we would expect. And certainly, you say your waters went early, you know, first, and that was your first sign of labour.
Yeah.
It's more likely for that to happen if baby is in what we call an OP, an occiput posterior, which is where the baby's back is against your back position. It isn't always the case that your waters will break first if baby's in that position, but we tend to see it more commonly in that position.
Do we know why?
I think it's often to do with the pressure being unevenly distributed onto the cervix, right, but causing a lot of pressure that will rupture the membranes. But babies don't tend to fit as easily into the pelvis. They have to turn, and it can be a sort of long labour where baby's doing a lot of work trying to turn from that position rather than focusing on dilation of the cervix, because babies aren't particularly well applied to the cervix.
You mentioned OP position. What's the other one?
So we would want babies to be in either a left or right. So we call them LOA or ROA, right or left occiput anterior. So with babies sort of looking sideways into the pelvis, that is the way they tend to fit into the pelvic brim most easily.
And with OP, how are they orientated?
So with OP, babies would be looking the same direction that you are, so their back would be against your back.
Right, okay, yeah. Because there's lots of sort of old wives' tales about things like, if you're pregnant, wash floors on your hands and knees, because that helps the baby sling over. I'm sure that was just a way to get women to do more housework. I remember through all the pregnancy forums, it was like nobody wanted to have an OP baby because labour was meant to be more difficult.
I think that as women, we particularly have a tendency to beat ourselves up and blame ourselves for things. And and I know that, you know, there is a lot of worry about having an OP baby and thinking it's because I sat down at my desk and I had to work until I went on maternity leave. There are things that we can do to help encourage babies, but babies will adopt the position they're comfortable in. You know, when we go for a scan, we get people doing star jumps and all sorts, and babies will persistently stay where they want to be. You know, we can do things to encourage, but we also can't beat ourselves up for something that's beyond our control.
No, absolutely. I wish I could speak to my grandmother who had 10 children, and I'm sure she would tell me that she did similar things and every baby's birth was slightly different. Unfortunately, I never got to speak to my great-grandmother who had 18 children.
Wow.
And I have to say that that gave me great confidence, because with my second child, I wore my grandmother's necklace. Mm-hmm. I put it on at 37 weeks. And I remember thinking, I've researched this and I need to just detach my brain from my body, mm-hmm, obviously not literally. And just, I put on her chain and I thought, she's birthed 10 children at home, all survived. And I thought, my body knows what to do. I mean, a little bit what you're saying about farming women that you know, who just, they've seen it, it's natural, and they trust their bodies. But I think we've become very afraid of birth. There's a lot of misinformation out there.
Absolutely. And I loved your Nona's necklace. I thought it was such a lovely connection to our ancestors. And I don't know about you, but certainly when I had my own baby, I felt very connected during pregnancy, labour, and breastfeeding to my ancestors and women throughout the ages.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So we're in labor, we've contracted, we are contracting, and our cervix is dilated. What happens next?
So sometimes once you are fully dilated, you can have a phase that's called rest and be thankful, where contractions can go off a little bit, almost as though, you know, you just need to have a little breather before the contractions change and you start to really feel that urge to push. It doesn't happen for everybody, but it is something that can happen. Equally, you mentioned during transition, which is a strange phase, and often women who are in hospital say they want to go home and they can't do this anymore. Or women who are at home will say they want to go to the hospital, and there is a big phase of just thinking, no, not doing this anymore, I give up, don't want to do this, and almost irrational thoughts. But it does pass, and it often is a sign that midwives are looking for, to think, okay, we're approaching time for birth now and pushing will start soon. And your body takes over, you know, in the way that a lot of women worry about, how will I know to push? But it's very, very similar to needing the toilet and having to open your bowels. You know when you need to poo, and your body sort of tells you how to do it, and pushing a baby out is very, very similar. And it literally can feel as though you need to open your bowels. It's the same part of the anatomy that the head is pushing on.
Yes, because some women can poo themselves during labour and they get sort of terribly sort of worried about that, but it's completely natural, isn't it?
Absolutely, and we've seen it all before, and midwives are very, very good at being very discreet about it. You know, birth partners often don't realise that's happened, and I've had many women who have had a bowel movement during labour say, oh, and I didn't poo myself.
Yes, you did. But also we're now finding out, I mean, slightly, you know, onto a different topic, but that first meal of poo and blood is actually very important to colonise the baby's gut, isn't it?
Absolutely. Baby's first vaccine, essentially. It's, you know, really important for microbiome.
So interesting you mentioned about pushing, because that's something, again, which we see a lot on the telly about push, push, push. And I remember when I was pregnant with child number two, and I told a couple of people I was trying for HVAC, home birth after cesarean, which obviously was quite a contentious subject with some people. But I met one woman who'd done it, and she really crystallised something for me. And she said, you know when you've got to push. She said, it's exactly like when you're sick, but the other end. And when you're sick, when you vomit, no one has to say to you, and now puke, and now puke. And it really, really made sense to me. I knew what I had to do. So why do we sometimes see that thing of push and women being told to push?
I think a lot of it is time scales in hospitals where we have augmented labour. So we've potentially given a hormone drip to speed up labour, or somebody's been induced, and as part of the steps of that, we've softened and ripened the cervix, broken the waters, and then started a hormone drip to start contractions. We do allow an hour after we have done a vaginal examination and found the cervix to be fully dilated before we start pushing. But often, because of all those drugs and people being very tired, sometimes an epidural or other drugs, that sort of being in tune with your body is disrupted.
Yeah, well, if you've had an epidural, you can't actually, you can't actually feel anything often.
Depends how dense the blocks are. So an epidural is a form of pain relief that completely blocks any pain or sharp sensations, but where you are still able to feel pressure. So an epidural is inserted into the epidural space in the spine by an anaesthetist, a very well-trained doctor. And epidurals are improving significantly compared to when I first started training, and we had to lift people's legs because they were so heavy and the block was so dense that women couldn't move around the bed themselves. Now women, they couldn't stand self-supported, but they've got a lot of mobility in bed and can often feel contractions, not the pain of contractions, but the pressure of contractions. So some women with epidurals still can feel a lot more than they used to, but they wouldn't tend to get that overwhelming desire to push. I think that's a perfect analogy to being sick. I think that's much better than needing the toilet, actually, because it very much is that involuntary.
Well, it's phasal, isn't it? Like when you vomit. It's really phasal, and that really made sense to me. And in fact, the pushing bit was great. It felt very productive and satisfactory. Amy, you mentioned a hormonal drip. What's involved in that? What is it?
So the hormonal drip is something called syntocinon, and it's an artificial version of what the body would naturally produce in labour and would cause contractions. And we use it in an induction of labour, but as one of the last steps of an induction. We wouldn't want to start contractions before the waters had broken and before the head was well applied to the cervix. So first of all, we would have to insert something called prostaglandins into the vagina, which soften and ripen the cervix. Then we hopefully would soften and ripen the cervix enough to dilate it just a little bit so that we could break the waters with something called an amni hook, which is a little bit like a crochet hook.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
It does sound awful, but it's actually very gentle and it's very tiny and just sits alongside the midwife's finger. But it has to be quite long, like a crochet hook, because we have to be able to hold it against our hand in order to use it. But generally, women wouldn't feel anything different to a vaginal examination.
So we are pushing. In your experience, does it vary? I mean, I think I was pushing for about 45 minutes from memory. But does it vary enormously, or is there pretty standard?
It does. Most women who are listening to their body and pushing when they are ready, a baby would appear within an hour to 2 hours. And I know that feels like an awful long time to be pushing. But as you've mentioned earlier, time, you know, gets a little bit fuzzy when you're in labour. And it doesn't feel that long when you are labouring and pushing. Generally, in hospitals, we would want to see progress within an hour, and we'd be looking for reasons why maybe we're not having a baby that's born within an hour of starting pushing. But sometimes with a first baby, it can take a little bit longer.
Why might a baby just not be born in an hour?
So if the contractions are not being particularly effective, so sometimes you can contract quite a lot, but they're very short and it's just not long enough for baby to sort of have those reflexes stimulated and navigate the pelvis well. Sometimes it can be that the contractions are not frequent enough, or if somebody's got an epidural, sometimes if the block is a little bit denser than we'd hoped, that mum isn't feeling where to push particularly well and isn't able to push effectively.
I just want to come back to something. I mean, it's not a lot of space for the baby to come down. So what's taking so long? Is it that it moves at like millimetre pace?
It is. And you know, we've got, mum's got to live with her pelvic floor health the rest of her life.
Right.
So you want that to stretch up slowly.
Right.
And, you know, it will all go back as it was. And some people do have very, very rapid births with no ill effects, but that doesn't tend to be with your first baby. Generally, that navigation through the pelvis happens quite slowly the first time, just to protect mum and baby.
Now, in terms of positions, I remember with child number two, she wouldn't let me sit down. What I wanted was a rope from the ceiling to hang from. I didn't have one, but that sort of feeling of hanging, because I remember I couldn't sit down the whole labour. Whereas with child number one, when I was in labour, I was walking around and bouncing on a ball, and it was really different. So obviously women have to find positions that are comfortable for them, but there are some positions that are more conducive to birth, aren't there?
The more upright you can be, the better generally, and that can be bouncing up and down on a ball, as you've mentioned, or wandering around. And that wanting to pull down from something on the roof is quite common. I know in my local birth centre, we have hooks on the ceiling, which we can wrap, cloth wraps that are very strong, and people can wrap them around their arms and really pull on those down from the ceiling, which can be very beneficial. Generally, all fours, upright positions. If you do need to rest during labour, which some people do, lying on your left-hand side is often quite comfortable. Or the use of water and, you know, can be really supportive in helping you adapt to different positions. But I think listening to your body is very important. I find it very interesting that women tend to adopt the same all fours position when they're having a breech vaginal birth, and there's something that helps the physiology. And so I think when somebody really feels that a position is comfortable in labour where the baby's head down, I think listening to your body is very important, because it's often helping and very intuitively knowing what the right position to adopt is for your baby navigating that part of the pelvis.
You mentioned if you want to rest, some people find it beneficial to rest on the left-hand side. Why the left?
We tend to say the left because most babies tend to have their back on the left-hand side of mum, but right. Left or right is fine. We just tend to say the left because of the major blood vessels are on the right-hand side. And so we don't want you to be flat on your back when you've got a large bump, and the left-hand side tends to be the most comfortable.
Yeah, talking flat on your back, of course, that is how it's often depicted, in fact, nearly always on the television. And I can understand why, because you want to see the actress's face that they've paid so much money for. I don't know any women who naturally go into that position giving birth, because your pelvis closes slightly, doesn't it?
It does. We all have that, the coccyx, the tailbone at the base of our spine, and that does move backwards and forwards and can be pushed out of the way when a baby's coming through. But if you're lying flat on a hard bed, it can't flex backwards. And so you're having to push a baby uphill around that curve of the tailbone, and it isn't able to move out of the way nice and freely. But it is the position that most people adopt on television, and people do tend to go into a room, see a bed and lie down when they're in labour. A lot of midwives will push the bed to the side of the room and try and not make it the focus, and only use it if it's necessary, and try and encourage people to walk around if they feel able to.
So crowning, what is crowning?
So crowning is the part where the vaginal opening is starting to part and the baby is visible externally, and the widest part of the baby's head is just coming out of the vagina.
And then once that comes out, because that bit tends to happen fairly or relatively quickly, doesn't it?
It's relatively quickly. It might be the part where if it's not your first baby, if it's happening very quickly, the midwife might try and advise you to breathe rather than actively push, just to prevent tears, that it can happen slowly. And sometimes we do use hot compresses. If somebody's not in a birth pool, hot compresses can feel very nice and just prevent stinging and prevent tearing as well at that point.
Because, yes, quite often you see on the telly as well, they're getting women to breathe and pant. I never felt the need to do that. What is that about?
It's if somebody's having directed pushing, for example, if they've got an epidural as pain relief and aren't feeling the urge to push in a natural way, the midwives might be directing pushing. And so we don't want somebody to push really with all their might at the point of crowning, because it would increase the chances of a tear. And so at that point, we try and say, stop pushing. And they don't necessarily need to pant, but we're just trying to think of a quick thing that people would be familiar with to not push.
To sort of distract them.
Yeah.
Okay, so baby's head has come out and then it turns, as I described, and then everything sort of is on fast forward, isn't it?
Yeah. So then you hope in a natural, normal birth that baby's shoulder would then be delivered under that bony prominence at the front of the pelvis, and then the rest of the body would follow pretty quickly.
What starts the breathing? As you remember, my second child was born in the water. And I remember the fact that she was underwater, but of course not breathing yet, still breathing through the umbilical cord. We know that obviously a baby can breathe through the umbilical cord, because otherwise how would they breathe in your uterus? But there was just something so graphic about her being in the water and yet not still breathing. And I know a question my children have asked, which is, how long can a baby do that for? Because obviously they're born and you pull them out, but she's still attached to my umbilical cord.
So babies, when they're born, will have some kind of stimulation. And often it's that the room that they're in, we want to make it cozy for babies, but it'll often be a little bit cooler than inside body temperature. And that will stimulate them to draw their first breath. And we've now got a lot of evidence. We used to cut and clamp the umbilical cord quite quickly and get babies and stimulate them. You know, we see in very old films, people slapping babies to try and get them to breathe and holding them upside down by the ankles. But now we know we do want to stimulate them if they're a little bit slow to take those first breaths, and we can give them a vigorous rub with a towel, but something a lot more gentler than we see in the old movies. But we tend to now leave the umbilical cord attached so that baby can have quite a gentle transition to breathing, and we can still rely on them getting oxygenated blood from the placenta while they adapt to life outside.
Yeah, I've always thought it's slightly mad that they have an oxygen supply and that's cut. But it's about placental transfusion, isn't it?
It is. And the placenta, if we cut and clamp very early, we'll still have a lot of oxygen-rich blood inside it. And so leaving it intact with baby and not cutting and clamping until a certain amount of time has passed or until it's completely stopped pulsating just ensures baby is not depleted of that oxygen-rich blood in the first days of life. The placenta, you know, it is the baby's lifeline and all the nutrients it needs to grow and develop while it's in utero, and certainly for that transition to new life.
My placenta did come out naturally. A hello world for that information. But why might it not come out? Because you can pass it naturally, or you can have a managed...
A managed third stage where you would have an injection of syntocinon or syntometrin to help the placenta detach. So it might not come out, particularly if somebody gets cold and the body sort of vasoconstricts, sometimes that can affect the placenta coming out. Sometimes just in the way that we're all slightly different, you can have a placenta that's just particularly adherent and it doesn't come out cleanly. But nature's pretty clever. For the majority of women, it will come out within an hour naturally with no complications at all. Putting baby to the breast, if you want to breastfeed, will stimulate the hormones to release the placenta. But some people have a higher risk of bleeding, or from the blood work that we've done in pregnancy, we're concerned about if they bled, their iron levels particularly low, or their clotting factors are low. And then we might recommend that they have an injection for a managed third stage, sort of preempt and reduce the chances of that high level of bleeding. The uterus contracts down, and as the uterus shrinks, the placenta detaches from the uterine wall and is ready for delivery. And where we've given syntocinon or syntometrin, the midwife would then gently pull on the cord to pull the placenta out. Whereas if we haven't given that injection and somebody's waiting to deliver the placenta naturally, we would wait for signs of lengthening and the feeling of contractions and ask mum to push the placenta out.
Yeah, I remember I didn't really want to let go of mine. I remember you saying if it doesn't come soon, we might have to think about giving an injection. And in the end, you put me on the toilet and it came out. Because I think I'd done so much work by that stage. I was like, oh, my God. Yeah, because I also wanted to try, what was it called? Lotus
birthing.
Where you carry around the placenta. And I remember you said to me, do you want to do that? And I was so tired that I was just like... swear word. I was like, that, because I was just like, no, I didn't want to do that. But lotus birthing is when you carry the placenta around until such time as it naturally detaches, isn't it?
It is. And often people pack the placenta with salt or herbs and have to wrap it in a little bag just to stop it smelling and becoming disgusting, because the placenta and cord do drop off by a process of gangrene. So it can often be a little bit smelly and gunky around a cord, whether it's left intact at a lotus birth or just left as a little stump to drop off in that first week or so of life.
One often hears sort of stories about, oh, the baby was born with a cord wrapped around its neck. Mm. But is that as dangerous as it sounds, given that the baby isn't breathing through its mouth?
Not necessarily. Lots of babies will be born with the cord around their neck. It's only an issue if the cord has wrapped around many, many times and is pulled, or even once, but where it's pulled particularly tight. So it can be quite normal for the baby's cord to be wrapped around its body or its neck. But if it doesn't pull tight, then the nutrients and the oxygenated blood will continue to flow to baby as it has been. So I think it's something that can be used to add a little bit of drama to television programmes when someone's birthing, but it rarely is an emergency.
What is meconium?
So meconium is the baby's first bowel movement, and that naturally would sit in the bowel in the later stages of pregnancy. And most babies would not pass that bowel movement until they've been born. But sometimes if a baby is stressed by an event in labour or late pregnancy, they might pass that bowel movement, you know, as we would when we're scared, you feel like you need to go to the toilet, and babies are no different from adults in that respect. So sometimes they might pass that bowel movement inside, and we would have what we call light meconium stained waters. So sometimes when the waters are broken, we can see that there's small pieces of meconium floating. Or if babies had a large bowel movement, thick meconium stained waters. And that's something we'd be a little bit more concerned about, because if babies hasn't been born and we're seeing that, it can be that as baby takes their first breath and gasps that they can ingest some of that meconium, which can be dangerous if it's in baby's lungs.
Because like a sort of semi-solid thing that they've inhaled.
Yeah, certainly. Meconium can be a very natural thing to see in labour at a breech vaginal birth, as babies are squeezed and the forces on their abdomen and the pressures during labour. We often say meconium looks like it's coming out of mum like toothpaste, because the baby's bowel will be squeezed and it will come out in quite a constant stream. And that's quite a normal stage for breech birth. It doesn't necessarily mean that baby's distressed.
Also, the baby can come out covered in this waxy thing. What's that?
So that's called vernix, and that would naturally be on babies to protect their skin, because they're in a bag of waters. It's just a sort of waxy substance that covers the baby entirely. And babies that are born prematurely tend to have quite a lot of vernix. Babies that are born at term tend to have nothing or very little. Sometimes you just see remnants of it in sort of eyebrows or hair or armpits and groin, and it remains, and it will just rub into the skin, or you can wipe it off and it doesn't cause any ill effects. It's just a nature's moisturiser, essentially.
A bit like those people that used to cover themselves in goose fat to swim the channel.
It does look exactly like that.
Yeah, and I guess it's the same, similar purpose. It sort of protects you against the waters.
Now, Amy, sometimes women need a bit of help in giving birth, and that's when, if you're in a hospital, because I don't think you can have this at home, you might need something called a vontuse or forceps, slightly crossing my legs at this stage of the conversation. Could you explain to our listeners what they are and why they might be implemented?
Yes. So if the baby isn't coming out as we'd expect just from mum pushing in the second stage of labour, sometimes it might be indicated that rather than do a cesarean section, because the cervix is fully dilated and baby is able to be born vaginally, but would need a little bit of help, we have options of forceps or vontuse. And it would be after a vaginal examination and an assessment of that specific situation, which would be the best one to use. So forceps are metal. They're a little bit like salad servers or tongs. They look a lot scarier than they are, because they need to be long to be able to reach the baby's head. And they're designed to be slightly curved and wrap round baby's head to protect the skull. It gives the doctor the opportunity to manoeuvre baby into positions to navigate the bony part of the pelvis to facilitate birth. Whereas a vontuse might be used if baby has navigated the majority of the pelvis and just needs help with that last part, the crowning part. And it's essentially like a little suction cup that would be placed on top of baby's head.
Like a plunger.
A little bit like a plunger, yes. And it just isn't, we don't suction baby out as such. Mum still pushes, but while mum's pushing, the doctor applies a little bit of gentle traction with that plunger to help guide baby out.
And that's when sometimes babies that have been born with a vontuse can have a slightly kind of sort of peaky head, can't they?
Yes.
Obviously it goes back.
It heals very, very quickly. And babies are designed to navigate the pelvis and have quite a little bit of swelling on their heads. They're tough. They expect quite a bit of force on them during labour. So they heal very quickly from a vontuse.
You were midwife before you became a mother, so that must have been super interesting, I'm imagining, for you. Was there anything, once you had yourself laboured, that either surprised you or that you're glad you knew? Sort of any kind of general tips, if you like, for people?
I was quite surprised when I laboured that it was very much as I expected in many ways, and I'd had lots of labour dreams, and I remember thinking, is this really it? Because it feels very much like the dreams I've had. But I think the thing that helped me most was hypnobirthing. I attended so many labours where women had been incredibly calm and had an enjoyable, positive experience of labour because they had hypnobirthed. I knew that was something I wanted to do.
And what is hypnobirthing?
It's practicing relaxation techniques and taking time in later pregnancy to do some guided visualizations, so playing recordings and pieces of music while you relax and think positive thoughts and visualize labor. You practice these techniques over and over in the latter parts of pregnancy, which is enjoyable in itself because it's taking some time for you and bonding with your baby. And then when you're in labour, you play those visualisations or those pieces of music. You can play them continuously or you can play them just if you are getting more anxious or things change to help bring you back to a state of deep relaxation. And I myself didn't have the most straightforward birth. I had preeclampsia and I had an induction of labour because of that. And it wasn't the home birth that I planned. But using techniques that hypnobirthing gave me in the visualisations, I had a very positive experience and remained very calm and relaxed. And I think they can be very useful techniques whether you're at home, hospital, or preparing for a cesarean section. I think hypnobirthing's helped me postnatally and in life beyond pregnancy enormously.
Yeah, well, you encouraged me to do hypnobirthing and I did do it and it was amazing. One of the visualizations I had, which I remember so vividly, was when the contractions came, I remember putting them in a little hot air balloon and mm-hmm. them going away. And it sounds really simple, but it really, really worked. And like you, I sort of also sometimes use it in an appropriate time and space to mm-hmm. relax myself. Because obviously our brains can really interfere with labour. And the more relaxed you are, the more you're letting your body deal with it. Because, you know, you're helping with everything like blood flow, mm-hmm. efficient hormones going around your body. So the more relaxed you can be, the better. Amy, thank you so much. Thank you so much for delivering my baby and my wonderful home birth after cesarean. And it's been great to talk to you. And thank you so much for being part of this.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's been lovely catching up.
Thank you so much to Amy, not only for delivering my baby, but for such a clear and calm explanation of what happens. Something I want to pass on that I learned after researching labour is a useful tip. It's not about babies, but about jumpers. If you ever can't get a jumper over your head, the temptation is to try to force the jumper with the opening near your forehead. This is where your head is largest, so don't do this. If instead you move the jumper to the top back of your head, the crown or vertex, this is where your head is at its smallest circumference. If the jumper is ever going to go on, it will if pulled on here. This also neatly tells you where the baby's head will present to the cervix, which is what we talked about in the podcast. If you're planning a birth, Birthrights is a really good organisation with lots of factual info, largely based, as the name suggests, around your rights and the law. The producer is Hester Kant, the music is by Toby Dunham, and our artwork is by Lo Cole. If you'd like to read my column, it appears every Saturday in The Guardian Saturday magazine.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is Annalisa. I started doing this podcast because it's an idea I really believe in, so much so that I decided to put my money where my mouth is and self-fund the project. I really want to keep releasing this podcast for free, so if you enjoy this episode, a way you can help is to visit our Acast supporter page and give what you can. You'll find the link in the episode description. Thank you.